being placed in the middle of a custody battle was agony to me, a girl whose entire young life had been devoted to pleasing everyone. How could I possibly choose to live with one parent at the expense of the other? While sitting in algebra class one day, the answer came to me, Joe Cheerhart. If I married him, the decision of which parent to live with would be a moot point. Of course, my other boyfriend, Warren Becker, would be disappointed, but hurting my mother or my father would be far worse. Joe was easy to convince, bless his heart. How could he resist when I explained that he was the only one who could help me with this terrible problem? Besides, he had hoped to marry me anyway someday. That night, I located my birth certificate and altered it so that my age read 18. The following day after school, we two teenagers took a streetcar across the state line to Kansas City, Kansas. The enormity of it all engulfed me as I stood before the justice of the peace. Had I really signed my whole life away to this boy beside me? I was a Catholic girl. Marriage was forever. A giant wave of homesickness swept over me at the thought of what I'd done. I had just been pronounced a wife, and all I wanted to be was my parents' little girl. What about our honeymoon? Joe had asked me, surveying his bride. I selected, if you can believe this, a white pinafore with matching bobby socks and Oxfords for the occasion. It's Friday, and we got 2 days before we have to go back to school. I don't think my parents would like it, I demurred. Let's just keep it our secret for a while. Joe wasn't entirely disappointed. He had his own parents to contend with. Agreeably, he'd taken me home, settling for a quick but ardent kiss before leaving me on the doorstep. Celeste was waiting in the living room, her eyes on the clock. Where have you been? Was her first question. And what's that bulge under your dress? Was the second. I looked down at the telltale bulge. Why had I been so careless? Of course I had to tell my parents something. That was the whole point of the runaway marriage. But not now. I wasn't ready. Would I ever be ready? The runaway marriage had seemed like such a grand and daring solution. It was obviously a disaster. I felt sick with remorse. My hand strayed to the front of my pinafore, trying to push it down. It's just a license, I murmured. I could never lie well. License? License to what, for God's sake? My mother yelled as I fled sobbing up the stairs. My mother retired with unprecedented urgency to her bath as my father pounded on my door, demanding to be admitted. You can't come in, Daddy. I'm a married woman. I'm in charge of my life now, I announced in a quavering voice. Not yet, I wasn't. To my immense but secret relief, my father had the marriage annulled. Unfortunately, there was nothing that he could do to prevent the appearance of the wedding announcement in the vital statistics columns of the newspaper. The punishment agreed upon by both sets of parents was that Joe and I would refrain from seeing one another socially. The romance was over before it began. Grandma Coyle came to the rescue, as she had so many times before. What are we going to do with Sylvia? Celeste reminded her. What are we going to do with you? Had been the answer. As a result of Ada's firm but tactful mediation, a compromise was reached once again, and life continued at the Shoemakers. After a few months, Joe Beam came along and filled the void in my affection. This Joe was a bit older. His formal education completed, he had a good job with a trucking firm and felt ready for marriage. I, too, was maturing. My elopement and its embarrassing aftermath had been a crash course in reality. Joe talked of a farm and 6 children. To me, with my growing need for security, that sounded just wonderful. But there was a major drawback. Joe was a possessive young man, and he wanted me all to himself. I was torn. I loved Joe, and fantasized about the life that we would have together. My dreams of becoming a teacher, maybe even a teaching nun, dated from early childhood. But I was recently begun to reconsider. Would having children of my own be even more satisfying? I pondered the question endlessly. For once, neither Grandma Ada nor Francine were of help. Wait was all that Ada could or would say. When the time comes, you'll know the right thing to do. As my high school years drew to a close, I realized that my adored grandmother was having serious problems of her own. She had a critical heart condition. An attack, the doctor said, would certainly be fatal. I was 18 and a college freshman when the call came that Grandma Ada had been hospitalized. Your grandmother wants you to have this, a nurse said, handing me a black crucifix. Ada was enclosed in an oxygen tent, her eyes shut. "Grandma, you have to get well. I love you," I said as I knelt beside her fragile body. Ada said nothing, but her china blue eyes opened briefly. "Go on, Sylvia. Go forward." The words were never spoken, but I heard them as clearly from her mind as if they'd been shouted. I sat for hours beside my sleeping grandmother. It was late evening before I returned home. The next day I returned to the hospital and began a vigil that would last several days. I was seated alone at Ada's side when my grandmother died. My mother was home in her bathtub. In the days that followed, Joe Beam was constantly at my side, offering love and support. "Why not quit college now? What's the point? We'll just be getting married when you graduate anyway," he urged. My father, admiring the young man's progress in the trucking line, had come to agree. "You don't need college to be a wife and a mother," he told me. My mother was vague. "Do what you want most, hon," was her only advice. Francine remained adamant. "You'll need this training," she insisted. "You will need your college education for the work that you will do. Teaching will be a part of it." Joe continued his efforts to persuade me to drop out of college. But as the months passed, an exciting new world opened up, exerting a powerful claim of its own. I was majoring in both education, literature, with a minor in theology. My old desire to teach had returned full force. Yet a part of me still craved the security I believed came from marriage. Now it appeared that although I tried with some success to exercise the paranormal side of my life, I still lived in two worlds. One was the college life. Late nights spent in philosophical and metaphysical discussions on Huxley, Kafka, Camus, Sartre, Bertrand Russell, Alan Watts. The other world was the real one, inhabited by Joe and the solid, home-centered life I envisioned with him. Finally, in my senior year, I agreed to the marriage. Having at last made a decision, I felt immense relief. Whether it was the right one or not scarcely mattered. A weight had been lifted from me. Now I allowed myself to be swept into the fury of preparations for a June wedding. Joe made a down payment on a house, and we were in the process of selecting furniture when again fate intervened. Business, not philosophy, was Joe's forte. Though only a few years older than my college friends, he sometimes felt out of place with them and rarely attended the parties I gave nearly every week. I've always wondered how my life might have differed had he been present that cold winter evening, February 2nd, when someone new walked in. "Meet my rescuer," my friend Maggie announced dramatically as she walked into my party. I was stuck in the snow, and I didn't hear the rest. I was staring at the greenest, most compelling eyes I'd ever seen. His smile, the force of his almost animal magnetism, literally took my breath away. The words, "tragedy, Sylvia," went screaming through my mind. The words were sharp and clear, a kind of psychic telegram from, who knows, maybe Francine, from God, who'd remained in the background for the past 2 years. It was the first time in months that she had communicated, "This is the beginning of the most difficult time of your life," were the words. The message was alarming, but I was 19 and looking to the eyes of my first true love, a tall, truly tall, dark stranger. "I am the hostess with the mostess," I introduced myself with the glibness that came so easily to me, but which often disguised my vulnerability. "I can see that," he said. He moved his rangy body with a graceful ease that reminded me of a panther. I found it immensely attractive. Everything about him was attractive, even his broken nose. All evening I could feel his eyes on me until finally I could stand the mounting tension no longer. "Why do you keep staring at me?" I asked him. "Because I have big eyes for you," he said. He was yet another Joe, Joseph Stemkowski, but I quickly named him Ski. That evening, almost at the moment of our meeting, my engagement to Joe Beam ended. I would tell him in the morning. For me, suddenly, passionately, aware of the reality of love, it was as though our four-year relationship had never, ever been. Ski was slightly mysterious. New in town, he'd come from New Jersey to study flight engineering. Dazzled by his good looks and charm, swept by the force of our mutual attraction, I spent every possible waking moment with him. I was happier than I'd ever been before, but bewildered too. Hidden behind the excitement was a nagging feeling that something wasn't really quite right. It was as if, in Ski, I'd found the other half of myself. I was ecstatic, yet just beyond the radiance, there was shadows nagging at me. Try as I might, I could neither dispel nor penetrate them. Released from the strictures imposed by Joe Beam, I resumed my readings. I received all sorts of information for others, but none, absolutely none, for myself. "What did you mean by tragedy?" I asked Francine again and again. "If there's something I should know, tell me," I pleaded. But after her initial warning, Francine remained curiously silent on the subject of Ski. "I've come to realize that a guide must stay silent so you will fulfill your destiny. They can help you through it, but there's certain things maybe they can't see or they're not allowed to see, because you're to fulfill that part of your destiny." Then one afternoon I encountered the other engineering student, a friend of Ski's. We chatted amiably about trivialities while I debated quizzing him. If anything was wrong, did I really want to know? At last, I forced myself to probe for the answers that had eluded me psychically. "Ski's wonderful, but why do I feel..." The guy's name was Angie, I never will forget. "Why do I feel, Angie, that something is terribly wrong?" He looked away, uncertain, avoiding my eyes. "Aren't you the one who's supposed to know everything? Aren't you psychic? How many times I've heard that refrain? Don't you have that lady that talks to you and tells you stuff?" "Not about me," I said. "I've never gotten any help from her with my personal life." "In fact, nothing about the future," I explained. "It never mattered much until now. Francine always said when the time came, I know when I needed to know. Now she doesn't say anything. I sense there's something I need to find out." "Well, there is," he admitted after a long pause. "Ski's married. He's got a wife back in New Jersey. A wife and two kids." In that instant, even today reading this, I can remember it. The world grew so dark and dirty. A Catholic girl, a married man, was impossible. I drove to the flight school determined to confront Ski. Perhaps there was a mistake, I reasoned, but I knew there wasn't. Ski knew the moment he saw me. "It was only a matter of time before you found out," he said dully. "Why didn't you tell me yourself?" "I didn't want to lose you," was his answer. I nodded then. An unbidden picture of a dark-haired woman with a small boy and girl appeared before me. He attempted to explain. "I was very young, a sailor away from home for the first time. She got pregnant. I had to marry her. But I really tried to make it work. It never did. That's why I came to Kansas City to study. I thought distance would give me some perspective. I never dreamed I'd meet someone like you. God knows I never meant for it to happen." I felt a wave of pain and guilt as I thought of Joe Beam. This terrible emptiness must be what he'd experienced. What a callous person I'd been. Life in that perpetual twilight, deprived forever of the warmth that was Ski, seemed a just punishment for my thoughtlessness, my cruelty. But right now I was very concerned about how could I survive this. "Will you see me tonight, one last night?" Ski pleaded. I nodded, unable to speak. 2 weeks passed. Each night was the last one. We were more in love than ever, a frantic, devouring kind of love. Then one afternoon a messenger came to my French class. Father Nadeau wanted to see me immediately in his office. He didn't keep me long in suspense. I'd scarcely seated myself before he began. "I have a letter from a Mrs. Joseph R. Stemkowski. Someone had informed her of her husband's involvement with one of our girls. Do you have any idea, Sylvie, who that might be?" "It is I, Father," I said. He turned away, looking absently out at the spring landscape, tender green shoots of life everywhere. He was very quiet for a while, and then he said, "Do you love him?" "Oh, yes, more than anything in this world." Sighing, he turned back to face me. "That makes it more difficult. You know, of course, what you must do." Father, I can't give him up. I've tried, but I can't. He looked at me with all the compassion. It's been a long time since I've seen that much compassion in anybody's eyes. He said, you must, Sylvia. You know that. This priest knew me so well. You'll find the strength to do what has to be done. His words echoed eerily. I could hear Grandma Ada not long before her death saying, within your weakness, Sylvia, there lies your strength sleeping. What did that mean, Grandma? I kept screaming inward, where are you? Explain it to me. Help me. I left the room without another word. Could anyone hurt as much as I did and not die from it? For every hurt, there is a reason to grow and to understand. The words were there. Suddenly, a response from Francine. But what good could they do? Francine's life on earth was over, my own just beginning. The years ahead stretched before me an empty, desolate wasteland. I waved my hand over my right shoulder in a gesture used since childhood to dismiss Francine. I'm tired of your spirit world platitudes. Go talk to someone else, I said. They won't hear me, she said. Because they're not crazy, I said. Don't start that crazy notion again, she replied. Do you know any sane people who have spirits talking to them? I replied. You always say that when you're overwrought, she said. Overwrought? I want to die. You won't, Francine said, and then was silent. The internal dialogue had ended. At home later that afternoon, I did call Ski. I told him about the letter and described my conversation with Father Netto. I've got to see you, he pleaded. No. No more. Never again. I forced myself to say this and then hung up before he could reply. There was one last call from Ski. My mother had answered the phone after listening to his message. She handed the receiver to me. I think you want to take this call, she said. The following evening, I drove Ski to the bus station. When this life's over, I'll meet you on the second star to the right, he said, getting out of the car. It's a date, I replied, trying to smile. Maybe if this reconciliation doesn't work out, I can. I shook my head. Failed promises were scattered about us like punctured balloons. It was no use. We had had 6 months together. I knew it was all that we'd ever have. Perhaps Ski knew it too. And perhaps some level, he knew even more. Just before he boarded the bus, he turned to me and said, write to the Browns. What? I exclaimed in surprise. What Brown? What do you mean? I don't know, he answered, looking at me in bewilderment. It just came into my head. It must be from a song or something. Then he was on the bus, the last passenger to board. It was June. I was 19. Within a week, I would graduate from college, but my world had ended. Create a void, and something invariably fills it. As Ski departure, not enough, I almost seemed to be seeking acceleration of my pain. Perhaps it was a secret wish for punishment, a need to flagellate myself still further for real or imagined sin. Or possibly it was a perverse desire to kindle deadened senses. Whatever the latent cause, my reason took the form of fear. College classes and abnormal psychology had opened a Pandora's box of doubts. According to the textbooks, there were 7 levels of abnormal behavior. I figured, at least 4. My agile mind leaped into the worst possible conclusion. I must be schizophrenic. And how could I, a schizophrenic, ever teach impressionable young children? Earlier, diverted by Joe and his constant talk of marriage, and later by my passionate romance with Ski, I'd been able to push those ugly thoughts from my mind. Now, with my whole being focused on teaching, my doubts virtually paralyzed me. Teaching had always been natural for me. From earliest childhood, my favorite toy had been a small blackboard and chalk. How can I teach children when I might be crazy? I went around asking, almost frantically, of anyone who would listen. No one took me seriously. Of course you're not crazy. My young women friends would invariably respond, surprised that I even considered the possibility. Then they changed the subject to their love lives. What does Francine say about Dave, they would ask, or there is this new guy. My parents, occupied as usual with their ongoing drama, would nod absently, assuring me that I was perfectly sane and suggesting that I forget teaching for a year and just have fun. They would go back to their bickering. Finally, I took the problem to my family doctor and then to my priest. What about the children, my pupils? Could I hurt them in any way? Both men were certain that I couldn't, but at my insistence, they referred me to a psychiatrist. The physician interviewed me extensively and subjected me to a battery of tests. At last, he responded, "I see a young woman who has a great devotion to her family and who wants very much to please. Is that bad?" "Hardly, as long as she remembers to please herself as well." I breathed a sigh of almost relief when he concluded, "You're quite normal, but something very paranormal is going on." Of course I knew that. Again, Francine was of no help, refusing to even discuss the question of my sanity. "Of course you must teach. It will be an important part of your training," was all that she could or ever say. Often when I thought of the question of my sanity, Francine would disappear as if annoyed. You see, I was the only one out of 300 years of psychics that had ever questioned the fact of sanity or insanity. They all just seemed to accept it as part of their genetic trial or tribulation. But I wanted to get to the bottom of it. Sometimes that analytical part of my nature has been really, truly aggravating, but it's also served me very well to investigate, especially when we get into the survival of the soul. Finally, with considerable trepidation, I arranged for an interview with Sister Regina Mary, the principal of a small parochial school. Within an hour, I emerged with the promise of a contract. I would be the only lay teacher in a faculty otherwise comprised of nuns. In September 1956, 1 month short of my 20th birthday, I began my teaching career. It was the first job, teaching or otherwise, that I ever held, and I was terrified. "Will they like me?" I asked Francine again and again while driving to school the first day. "Of course they will," the spirit replied her in no-nonsense fashion. "Haven't you spent years preparing for this?" On the first day of school, 55 students waited for me. The impact of their eyes was staggering as I entered the assigned classroom and carefully set up my easel, glad to have something to hide behind. After just a few days of nervousness, though, I fell right into the task of being both teacher and friend to my students. I sometimes held the wastebasket for the children when they threw up, and occasionally I pulled their teeth, kissed away their tears, and bandaged a skin knee. I showed them how to close their eyes and visualize what they wanted to be. And every single day, I told them how much I loved them. None of the children ever seemed to think it strange that I knew that they were angry or upset because they hadn't had any breakfast, or witnessed a violent argument at home, or overheard an older sister tearfully announce that she was pregnant. No one ever said, "How do you know?" when I took them aside for a reassuring little chat. It was simply taken for granted that Miss Shoemaker knew everything. Late on a Friday afternoon in November, I sat at my desk grading papers. With a happy sigh, I set the last one aside and sat down surveying the room. The basement classroom might be the least desirable one in the school, but it was my room and I loved it. Besides, I made it all so bright and cheerful with pumpkins and autumn leaves that you hardly noticed that there were any windows. My confidence was growing. Some of the spit and polish shine was off the patent leather teacher, but the enthusiasm had endured. "What do you think, Grandma?" I asked aloud. There was no answer, but I felt a warm glow envelop me. The next afternoon, the phone rang. It was Sister Regina Mary. The school principal never called on weekends. I must have done something awful, I thought, but what? "Is everything all right?" I forced myself to ask. "I hope you won't think I'm crazy," said Sister Regina Mary apologetically. "But the strangest thing happened just now." "Tell me, sister." Haltingly, the woman began to explain. "I came to the school this afternoon to finish some reports. Naturally, the school was deserted. I was in my office working when I heard a noise downstairs. I really knew I was the only one there, and I couldn't imagine who could have gotten in without setting off the alarm." Relieved, I couldn't help smiling as I thought of the school. It was a veritable fortress. The nun continued. The more I listened, the more it sounded like someone walking, so I picked up my crucifix and ventured down to the lower level. I smiled again. Lower level. That's where I was, in the basement, complete with furnace and ducts. The door was open, which in itself was strange because all the teachers expected to lock their doors before leaving. Oh, I did. I remember locking it. Yes, I know you did, Sister Regina agreed. I always check everything myself before I leave. Your room was properly locked last night, but just a few minutes ago I looked in. The door was wide open, and there in the middle of the room was a woman. What was she doing? I asked, mystified. Nothing, just looking around. I asked if I could help her, and she said, no. Just tell Sylvia that I wanted her to know that I think she's doing fine. I just stopped by to have a look at her room. Did you ask her name? I spoke softly. Yes, but all she said was, never you mind, she'll know. I went back upstairs to answer the phone. When I returned, she was gone. There was just no way that she could have gotten in or out without my seeing her or without someone triggering the alarm. I don't mind telling you, Sylvia, I just don't know what to make of it. What did she look like? I inquired, beginning to tremble. She was about 5'7", with pure white hair. I guess it was done sort of in a Gibson girl style. She wore a navy blue dress and smelled of lavender. The scent lingered in the room after she left. Sylvia, the nun said, do you know her? Yes. What's the meaning of it? Who was it? The principal's voice was suddenly stern. My grandmother. But how did she get in or out? It was easy for her, I said. What do you mean, sister said. She's dead, I said. I see, the nun abruptly changed the subject to a trivial school matter and soon terminated the conversation. The incident was never discussed again. Grandma Ada's visit was a turning point in my professional life. It was affirmation that I was, indeed, at the right place at the right time, doing the right thing. I would never, ever doubt my sanity again. Well, at least not for a while. Chapter 4, Growing Pains. Determined to forget Ski, I threw my energies into teaching, into parties, into readings. It didn't help. It wasn't enough. Nothing was enough. Then one day a nun, one of my teaching colleagues, asked me for a reading. Could you tell me what my life might have been like if I hadn't been a nun, she asked. There was a man. I loved him very much, but... In my mind's eye, I got a clear picture of a vital, handsome man in his early 20s. He loved you too, I said, but there was so much pressure from your family. You just weren't able to stand up to them. The nun nodded. Yes, that's right. At the time, I felt there was nothing else that I could do, but now sometimes I think of him and wonder. I hugged her spontaneously. Of course you do, but I'm afraid I can't tell you anything about what your life might have been. What I read are blueprints. Yours was to be a nun, and you're following that blueprint. There's nothing else to read. The life you're leading is the one you were always meant to lead. After the sister had left, I sat for a long time speculating on my own blueprint. For a short time, Ski had been my entire life. I loved him as much as ever, but I accepted the fact that he could never be mine. I mourned my lover as though he were dead, for indeed he was dead for me. I adored teaching and took pride in knowing that I was good at it. But that wasn't enough. No matter how much of myself I poured into my career, it was never enough. An enormous void remained. My life lacked purpose. That evening I called my priest, Father O'Connor, and made an appointment. We talked for hours. Perhaps the reason that you knew Ski's love and yet were strong enough to deny it is that you were meant to be a nun, he suggested. Remembering my childhood fascination with convent life, I listened thoughtfully. Throughout my growing up years, the church had been a refuge, providing solace and retreat from the ongoing chaos at home. A few weeks later, without discussing my plans with anyone, I sat down with Father O'Connor and petitioned to enter the Franciscan order. The formalities would take about 6 months, I was told. I continued my life without change. It's the only way you can be truly certain that convent life is for you, Father O'Connor assured me. Marriage or a convent? The painful uncertainty again emerged. The need to decide once and for all loomed large as my 21st birthday approached. The Friday night of my birthday at Loose Ends, I called my friend Maggie. What shall we do tonight? I have a date, Maggie told me. Jerry finally asked me out. Jerry, the policeman? The one you've been after for months? That very one. Suppose I call him and he's got a friend. A blind date? I don't think so. I'm almost a nun, I said. We both laughed, realizing how outrageous that really did sound. I'd really like you to come, Maggie persisted. I'm awfully nervous. Having you there would really help. We'll stay together. And even if you don't like him, we could have fun just going out. You don't want to stay home on your birthday, do you? I really didn't. And Maggie called back a few minutes later and announced that Jerry did indeed have a friend. The two officers were off duty at 9. Still feeling apprehensive, I went with Maggie to meet her at the police station. Gary Dufresne had sharp features. In my opinion, he also had the most intense dark eyes. Not bad, really, for a blind date, I decided. I'm Sylvia Shoemaker, I introduced myself, adding when he remained silent, and I'm a school teacher. Maggie had forgotten all about introduction. She'd also forgotten her promise that we'd remain together. Jerry and I will go in his car, and you can meet us somewhere, she announced. When Gary and I arrived at the bar, my first bar, in fact, what a relief it was to find Maggie and Jerry already seated in the booth. There was a flurry of small talk and then a lull, finally broken by Gary. Now, Miss Sylvia Shoemaker, school teacher, if we were alone, I'd ask you to tell me about yourself. I hesitated, but not Maggie, who explained. She's part Jewish and Catholic, and she can tell people about their future. A fortune teller, huh? Gary remarked. He eyed me very speculatively, then added, I've never cared much for Catholics or Jews either. I instantly dismissed ours as an amazingly brief, uncomplicated association and looked about the room. It was cheap and shabby. I felt a wave of misery and loneliness. I was picking up those damn vibes again, and they were awful. Neither of us said much more to each other until we left the bar and Gary unlocked my car door for me. How about going out some night? Sure, I replied, though I had no intention of seeing him again. I was surprised by his suggestion. It seemed so obvious that I wasn't his type. I wanted nothing more than to end this evening as quickly as possible. Explanation or arguments would only have prolonged it. Maybe that's the way cops are, unpredictable, Maggie suggested the next day, adding, What do you think of Jerry? It doesn't matter, I replied. He's not the one for you. Now you're beginning to sound like my mother. I shrugged. Sorry about that, she said. I have to tell you what I see. Jerry's fine, but he'll only be a short-term thing in your life. There's someone else. You haven't met him yet. I went on to describe this heavy-set, red-haired male that my friend would eventually marry. He's in the army. You'll meet him in a year. 6 months later, you'll be married. And what about you, Maggie challenged. If only I knew. The longer I teach, the more I'm around children, the more I'd like to have my own. But then I think about the church, the peace, the wonderful tranquility that it offers. Who can tell about marriage? Suppose I ended up like my mother. I should think Francine could give you some help with this. She's no help at all, I said. The best I can get from her is that my blueprint already exists and I have only to follow it. What good is a message like that? October drew to a close. It was Halloween night, and I was ready for some excitement. When the phone rang, was Gary inviting me out for a late dinner. Oh, why not, I thought. I surprised myself by responding, but it barely hung up when my misgivings began. And here's where we don't listen to our first impressions. A few minutes later, I called him back. I'm awfully sorry, but my aunt's visiting us, and she just broke her leg. I have to drive her to the hospital. That's a shame, he said. I was really looking forward to seeing you. I am sorry, I said. Maybe another time. But I vowed there'd never be one. That evening, Maggie and I went to a horror movie. Gary called a few minutes after you left, Maggie's mother informed us when they returned. I had no idea you lied to him, Sylvia. Naturally, when he asked where you girls were, I told him. Really, I should think you'd know better than to tell such a ridiculous story to a policeman. I never lie to anybody. I hate lies. It was stupid of me. I'll never do it again, I said, and meant it. The incident wasn't the end of Gary. To my surprise, he called again and again. The fourth time, I gave in, but insisted that Maggie accompany us on a date. Gary's mild disgust was thinly veiled, and this time I was certain I'd seen the last of him. However, when Gary took to dropping by unexpectedly after work, I realized that he wasn't the type to be easily discouraged. Though really exasperated at first, I began to look forward to his visits when I discovered that beneath the laconic exterior was not only a dry sense of humor, but an agile mind. Gary and his friends were older, more worldly than the men I knew. Cops and robbers' world was new and exciting to me. When 2 whole weeks passed with the only fleeting thoughts of Ski, I began to hope I was getting over him. Chapter 5, Following the Blueprint. With Christmas approaching, I had decided to visit a young man I knew in Indiana, but that trip turned out to be an ill-fated one for many reasons. I was relieved to return home at the turn of the new year, but my train was delayed by near blizzard conditions. At 3:30 in the morning, when it finally pulled into Kansas City, Union Station, the whole place was full. Revelers celebrating the new year were everywhere. Scanning the many faces, I saw my father almost immediately, then my mother, and behind her, Gary. "When your dad said you were coming home, I thought I'd better meet your train," he explained. "I've got this party. I'd like you to go with me. If I waited till tomorrow to ask you, you'd probably have something else to do, like taking your aunt to the hospital or something." I winced. My father answered before I could open my mouth, "Of course she'll go." "Will you, Sylvia?" Gary persisted. "Why not?" I was too tired to respond to the embarrassing jibe. By the time we reached the house, I had nodded off. It was Gary who wakened me. "You really will come? You won't forget or change your mind again?" he gently prodded while helping me out of the car. I agreed, dazedly, my thoughts only of sleep. It had been such a very long day. "I promise," I said. At the front door, Gary kissed me quickly and was off into the icy dawn. That evening, after sleeping most of the day, I felt refreshed and almost happy. I dressed with special care, extending a sleekly, simple black dress with a pearl necklace and earrings, my father's Christmas gift. My hair was swept up into a French twist. At 21, I'd loved and lost. Hardly a woman of the world, I still sought to pass for one. I winked at myself in the mirror, suddenly pleased with the image reflected there, which has not always been the case, I might add. The young man who greeted me downstairs shared more of my newfound confidence. It was a Gary I'd never seen before. He actually appeared nervous. Our arrival at the party was greeted with eager enthusiasm. The police officers and their wives who crowded about us seemed oddly conspiratorial. I began to feel like the key character in a mystery plot. "Did your folks tell you anything?" Gary asked me and led me to a large couch in the middle of the family room. "About what?" "Don't you know? Psychically, I mean." "Really, Gary, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, I don't know everything. Maybe once in a while a message comes through for me, but not often, and never when I try. It may seem a little strange to you at first, since we haven't exactly been dating, but I've known since the first time I saw you." "Known what?" I asked, feeling myself drawing away. "I'll get to that in a minute. Maybe I should tell you a little about myself. I never like to talk about personal stuff, but now I guess I'd better. I was an army brat. I lived in nearly every state in the Union. Then went to high school in Japan and spent 4 years in the Marines. I've been with the police department for nearly 3 years. I like it here. I'm ready to settle down. I want to settle down." In Gary's mind, everything was about to be settled. "That's all very interesting," I prompted him, "but I've been through a lot lately. I want to know where this conversation's going." "I'm getting to that." He turned to face me squarely. "I found out right away about that guy in Indiana. I guess that's over now." Gary continued, taking my hands in one of his. "I also know you petitioned to become a nun. I hope you won't go through with it because you'd be ruining my plans." "What plans?" I asked, my voice almost a whisper. "I found you in 1958 and I want to marry you in 1959. Before I could say one word, he reached into his pocket and brought out a blue velvet box. When I didn't take it, Gary removed the top to reveal the largest diamond I'd ever seen. The events of the last 24 hours were just too much. I began to cry. Gary put his arms around me reassuredly. "You'll get used to the idea, honey. Your parents are already delighted. They like me. You know they weren't very happy about either of your plans. Moving to Chicago was bad enough. But the convent? They're praying you won't enter. Either way, they'd be losing you. You're everything to them. You know that." I did indeed know that. I'd always been the glue that held the Shoemaker family together. What would happen to them without me? But now, didn't I deserve my own life, a life apart from the needs and desires of others? I shook my head as though to clear it and returned to Gary. "I don't know what's best for them, or me or anybody," I admitted finally. He closed my hand over the ring. "Keep it a while and think about it. Please, Sylvia, it won't hurt to think about it." At that moment, the other guests burst excitedly into the room. It was obvious that they could contain their impatience no longer. "Congratulations! How thrilling! We're so happy for you both. When's the wedding?" Once again, I felt that I was a central character in a drama, and maybe a bad one at that. One that was becoming more romantic and possibly exciting all the time. It was hard not to get caught up in it all. "We'll see," I murmured. "We'll see." Returning home in the early hours of 1959, I found my parents waiting up anxiously. It was obviously that they were solidly behind Gary. Their reasoning was persuasive. After all his years of traveling, Gary was eager to set down roots, happily in Kansas City. My life with him could be really good, giving me the children I wanted and the security I needed. And my parents supported a match that would bring them the grandchildren they longed for to keep their little girl from straying far away. And that, I found out, had more truth than fiction. Why, there was even a nice apartment for rent just down the street. My mother was certain that it was just the thing for me. She and my father would be more than happy to help with the furnishings. I listened absently. Perhaps they were right. I admired Gary's self-assurance, no doubt about it. Here was a man who knew what he wanted and went right for it. I could learn a lot from his single-mindedness, I thought at the time. The next day I went to see Father O'Connor. Telling him of my plans was more difficult, but there was some compensation in the marvelous sense of relief that accompanies the final resolution of a difficult issue. I felt almost giddy. Soon my life centered entirely around Gary. For the next few weeks I taught, came home, and rested. At midnight, Gary got off duty and we spent 3 hours together. Then I went to bed and slept, if I was lucky, until it was time to get up and teach again. Friends called, leaving messages, but there wasn't much time to return their calls. Finally, one Sunday afternoon, a group dropped by. When they pressed me about my absence, I flashed my diamond mischievously and replied, "I've been busy." They were excited shrieks. I was heady with the knowledge of what I had done on my own, without discussing it with anyone. "Who is it?" they asked at once. "Gary." "Gary who?" "Oh, you haven't met him yet," I said. "He's a policeman." My elation began to dissipate in their silence, a silence I realized that implied doubt and concern. "He loves me," I added defensively. "Again, you can't know him very well." "2 months, that's long enough," I insisted. "And Francine, what does she say?" asked a friend who'd known me since grammar school. "She says that I'm destined to follow my blueprint." "What the hell does that mean?" "I don't know, but whatever it means, it's happening," I declared briskly, putting an end to their questions. Going all the way before marriage was a mortal sin. But that didn't mean that it didn't happen. I wondered occasionally why Gary didn't even try. It must be because he respects me so much, I reasoned. Such reticence from a man who'd seen so much of life was touching. It also made life less complicated for me in the hectic weeks before the wedding. Gary and I were married on April 2nd, 1959, at St. James Church. The magnitude of what I was doing finally hit me the night before the ceremony. It was though I had wakened from a dream. "What am I doing?" I asked Maggie. "I don't love Gary. I don't even know him." "It was a rebound romance. We all knew that," Maggie said. "We all tried to tell you." I buried my face in my hands and began to cry softly. The loss of Ski had been so much for me. I think that I just didn't care anymore. "You don't have to go through with it," Maggie reminded me. "It's not too late to stop." But for me it was. All the plans had been made, the invitations, the gowns, the flowers, the caterers, the music. For days I'd been receiving wedding gifts. The priests, the attendants, my friends, my parents, and of course Gary. All were expecting to fulfill my promise. How could I disappoint them? In the crowded church I was suffocating. I wanted to scream, but no sound came from my smiling lips. Once again I performed on cue, walking down the aisle on my father's arm. As I knelt before the priest, I noticed that his shoes needed shining. I stole a look at Gary. Who was that stranger? Then the final words, awful and irreversible, were spoken. We newlyweds were walking down the aisle and out the door amid a shower of rice at the lavish reception where champagne flowed freely. I finally discovered Gary in an adjoining bar drinking something stronger. Did he, too, have regrets, I wondered. The time came for us to leave. Tears, hugs, goodbyes, over. We were finally alone in Gary's car. For more than an hour we drove, half-hearted attempts at conversation going nowhere. It was a late Thursday afternoon. We both had to be back at work on Monday morning. "Where are we going?" I asked at last. We were approaching a sign that read, "Sedalia, Missouri." "This sounds like a good place as any," Gary said, turning into a motor inn with an adjoining restaurant. Gary ordered liver and onions for dinner. I had the same. Wasn't it the companionable thing to do, both of us seemingly at a loss for words? The dinner stretched on forever. At last the check came. Gary paid it, and we rose, and walked silently to our room. It was drab, cheerless, ordinary. I turned on the radio. The tune playing was a current hit, Love is a Many Splintered Thing. Later I dubbed it to be Love is a Many Splintered Thing, but not at the time. I scarcely knew whether to laugh or cry.
This concludes side B. Please fast forward to the end of the tape and go to the next cassette to continue the program.